Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's forum event. My name is Beth Hannan. I'm the Associate Director of the Forum. For those of you who don't know us, the Forum has been putting on philosophy-themed events like tonight's for the last 20 years. They're all open to the public, most of which are free to attend as well, and that's thanks to the immense generosity of our donors and, of course, the support that the LSE gives us. Just a couple of housekeeping matters. If you have a phone, you can leave it on, but please do turn off the volume. But if you want to tweet along, you can just about make out the hashtag there. If you want to tweet along tonight, that's totally fine. We're also recording this for a podcast, so if you ask a question, do bear in mind that your voice will be recorded and put out there. And finally, if this isn't enough philosophy for you, we also have a blog, which we'd encourage you to go and have a look, and hopefully you'll see something that you like there as well. Anyway, that's all from me. I'll hand you over to Danielle for tonight's talk.
Thanks, Beth. I'd also like to add my welcome to Beth. Lovely to have so many of you here this evening. This evening's event will be focusing on the question, does philosophy have to be obscure? And we have three speakers, Professor Andrew Benjamin, who will be speaking first, Dr. Joseph Scheer, who will speak next, and finally, Dr. Simon Swift. Each speaker will respond informally to the question for about 10 minutes, and then we will have a discussion between them, and then we will open to the floor for questions. I think Andrew Benjamin will be speaking first.
Thank you very much, and just to thank the organisers for the kind invitation to speak here tonight. As soon as I was invited, I naturally looked up the word obscure in the dictionary to see what it is that philosophy ought or ought not to be. And the word obscure is, of course, deliciously complicated. It borders on the obscure in the sense to obscure something is to hinder it from being seen properly. To obscure something is to render it difficult. There are other meanings of the word obscure. But what they all seem to gesture towards is the possibility of not being obscure. And it's this that I'm interested in. Because one of the things that philosophy is always accused of is, and it's a dreadful word, it's a word that I would never really use in public, but I will this once, it's the accusation of using jargon, as though other disciplines didn't have a terminology, as though jargon was in some sense something that one could get rid of. And it could be got rid of were the world a simple, straightforward place. The difficulty of the world is that it's neither simple nor straightforward. Journalism and the 5-minute or the 5-second soundbite would like to render the world simple and understandable and straightforward, as though it could easily be explained by a series of propositions. Any real philosophical position is premised on the naivety of empiricism. It's premised on the naivety of empiricism. The great German philosopher Hegel had this wonderful sort of knockdown argument against empiricism, and it was the following. You imagine you have in your hand, you can all do this if you wish, you imagine you have in your hand a cube. It could be either of salt or of sugar. It depends whether you're a sweet or sour person, whatever way you want. The empiricist is constrained to say the following. I can feel the points in my fingers. I can feel the pointy bits as they push in. That I feel, I sense that it's empirically there. I see its whiteness, and it's brilliant white. It has a sort of luster. It twinkles at me. I can see that. It's empirically there. My tongue slips between my lips, and I lick the cube. It's either salty or sweet, depending on what you want. I can taste it. That taste is empirically there. And then Hegel pauses and thinks, I've got them. What's not empirically there is the coherence of those elements. You have to understand that those elements cohere and they cohere in their difference. You cannot see coherence. You have to understand the coherence. So if you are naive enough to believe in empiricism, which is endearing, it's the sort of thing that six-year-olds do and you encourage them, hoping they'll go beyond it, enter philosophical puberty and come out the other side. What becomes more interesting is once you recognize that the world's not given to you in a series of identifiable empirical events, but the world calls on you to understand its coherence or its incoherence. At that moment, this wonderful thing starts that philosophy is committed to. And the thing that starts is thinking. In other words, there's a challenge. What's given cannot be understood in the terms in which it is given. Therefore, the given is never an end in itself. As such, I obscure the given by not allowing it to appear as itself. I obscure it by attempting to render it understandable. And it seems to me that the project of philosophy, in being linked to the question of understandability, of causing something to be understood, in moving from the domain of empiricism, becomes of necessity obscure if what's obscured is the naive belief that the world's there in a series of discrete empirical entities. The other nice part about obscurity is the following. Well, let me give you another... Let's change the word obscurity to another word that is much nicer. If I say I'm going to adumbrate, I'm going to remove something out of the clouds, I'm going to make it clear. When I make something clear, I overcome another version of obscurity. That version of obscurity that would hinder my seeing something. Where does this occur? How does this occur? Let's pose that question. Let's become naive again. Let's say the world's reducible to cups on tables. I know it, I see it, it's immediate. Neither time nor is involved, nor is a question of judgment involved. Both are obviated, both are unnecessary. However, once I can move away from the position that reduces the world down to a series of cups on tables, two things emerge, and two things that are fundamental. One is knowledge and epistemological claims cede their place to the centrality of judgment. I make a claim about it, someone else makes a claim about it, my claim is a judgment, it becomes disputable. The notion of disputation brings with it the necessity for two things that are fundamental. One of them is the space in which we dispute. So in order for there to be a space of disputation, what Hannah Arendt would call the space of appearance, what Kant calls Offenlichkeit, the openness, once that's there as the locus of disputation, it's necessary that things be loci of judgment. In other words, that they be obscure in order that that space is allowed, because that space is what we call democratic civil society. So obscurity is there to bolster democracy. Democracy, ironically, depends upon obscurity. Final point. The other thing that is fundamental to this is a notion of temporality. As I always say to my students, the English word immediacy has two meanings. One is now, the now of its happening. Immediately she left the room. On hearing him speak, he stormed immediately from the room. It denotes a now. But the other much cooler thing about the word immediacy is that it's the negation of the mediate. So the immediate is the negation of the mediate. Mediation is that which takes time. Judgment is linked to mediation. Judgment is linked to the space in which it occurs. So we need to move from the realm of immediacy to the space of judgment. And in the space of judgment, we have the sticky, messy business of making decisions. And making decisions and judgments and debate all takes time. If things were patently clear, which clearly they're not, then we would not need judgment. We would not need mediacy. Everything would be immediate. It would be like this, like this, like this. There would be no space or need for the contestable decision. Therefore, I think that philosophy has to see itself as obscure precisely because obscurity is the reality of things. If you think about a court of law, a judge makes a decision. Every decision, in virtue of being a decision, is contestable, which means that the decision initially was obscure, precisely because it's contestable. There aren't uncontestable decisions. Go to a doctor, he or she may say, well, I think you should lose weight. The other doctor, who's a little portly themselves, says, no, you're perfectly fine. In other words, the doctor, him or herself, will always wrestle with the question of judgment. There is no final answer. So therefore, in defense of the democratic, in defense of the notion of judgment, in defense of the temporality of mediacy, philosophy is obliged to remain obscure.
Thank you. Okay, so I think that's a clear yes from Marcus. Over to you, Dr. Joseph Shea.
Thanks, Danielle. Does philosophy have to be obscure? I want to begin with a few remarks about the formulation of the question. Philosophy, like all interesting human phenomena, is a social and historical phenomenon. It's not what philosophers call a natural kind. Water is a natural kind. To be water is to be composed of H2O. Does water have to be H2O? Yes, by necessity, water is H2O. It's blissfully there, water, rolling down the river, blissfully independent of anything having to do with humans. In philosophy, by contrast, there are no necessities. Philosophy doesn't have to be clear. It doesn't have to be obscure. It doesn't have to be anything. It's an activity. It's an extraordinarily diverse activity with a long history. Philosophy is about asking questions and trying to come up with answers to them. There have been lots of different questions, lots of different approaches and ways of trying to answer them, and lots of different modes of expression in approaching these questions. The essay, the aphorism, the dialogue, the guide, the systematic treatise, the geometric proof. So philosophy doesn't have to be anything clear, obscure, or anything else. Philosophy is what we make of it. Of course, philosophy can be obscure in some sense, and the presumption of the question, I take it, is that philosophy is, on the whole, obscure, and the question is, does it have to be that way? As it's practiced today, does it have to be obscure? The question, somewhat hopefully, somewhat desperately, one might say, asks, does it have to be that way? Well, I think the presumption of the question is mistaken. Much philosophy in the Anglophone world and elsewhere is not at all obscure. It's accessible to anyone who has the inclination to read it. I could cite countless classic essays of the last half century or century, but take Harry Frankfurt's essay on bullshit, published in the late 70s, I believe, and then reissued and became a bestseller about 10 years ago. It's an account or a theory of bullshit. The essay is beautifully clear, astute, and subtle. It's an exposition of something that we all, in some sense, understand, know, indeed, practice. But we have a hard time saying exactly what it is. The thesis that Frankfurt offers is that the bullshitter has no concern for the distinction between truth and falsity. Contrast the liar, who's concerned to hide the truth and so curiously, in a way, respects it. So all Frankfurt's essay requires is that its reader be a competent speaker of English or whatever other language it was translated into. Now, not all philosophy is like that, of course. I work in a place where I have a number of colleagues who work in the philosophy of physics. Understanding their work requires a background in physics, which takes time to acquire. But that's not a very interesting sense of the obscurity of philosophy, is it? Does physics have to be obscure? Well, yes. To someone who doesn't know anything about physics, likewise for the philosophy of physics. Now, this should remind us of something about the word obscure. It always raises the question, obscure to whom? There's no such thing as obscurity in the abstract. Obscurity is a function of context, more specifically of perspective, in this case, the perspective of the audience of philosophy. Does work in cutting-edge philosophy of physics have to be obscure to the lay reader who knows next to nothing about physics? Yes, probably, which is why it's obscure to many philosophers, including myself. Does it have to be obscure to people who work in the philosophy of physics? No, and the best work in this area is not dark or obscure or enigmatic to those who are in a position to appreciate it. Now, beyond this uninteresting sense, I would say, of obscurity, I'll close by briefly mentioning three ways in which obscurity has in fact been part of the self-understanding of philosophy. Three ways in which the philosopher might say, yes, philosophy as I understand it, here and now, has to be obscure. So the first way I associate with the philosopher and political theorist Leo Strauss. He wrote, among other things, an essay, a well-known essay called Persecution in the Art of Writing, where he put forward the historical thesis, mainly, that many ancient and early modern philosophers, in order to avoid persecution, disguised their most heterodox or controversial ideas. So if you think of your audience as including those in power, and your ideas as perceivable as a threat to that power, then you might be interested in the art of obscurity. The second way of responding, yes, is what I'll call the critical theory response. In the late 90s, I think it was, Philosophy and Literature, which is a journal in philosophy and literature, came up with a prize that would offer every year for the best of bad writing. And one year, Judith Butler, the well-known philosopher and critical theorist, I think she understands herself as that, and social theorist, gender theorist, won the prize in the late 90s. And she wrote a defense of herself in the New York Times, and she claimed to be inheriting the critical theory tradition in early 20th century German philosophy, particularly Adorno and Marcuse. On this line, one ought to be writing inaccessibly, because a style of writing comprehensible to only a few readers stands the best chance of evading the alienation of being turned into a mass market commodity, or as Andrew put it, a soundbite, under conditions of capitalist production. So Adorno, in a well-known remark, says, "The advocates of communicability are traitors to what they communicate." So if you think of your audience as mostly cogs in the administered life of late capitalism, then the practice of obscurity might be considered a tactic of resistance to the current social world. Third and last, I'll call the Socratic response. What was Socrates up to? Well, many things: fighting for Athens, being a father, drinking hemlock, and the rest of it. But what makes him the long-lost love object of all philosophers is this, that he set out to challenge the arrogant knowingness of his culture. The task of philosophy in such a setting is first to render purportedly known things obscure, to clear the ground for the possibility of genuinely coming to know those things. So if sophists or those influenced by sophists are your audience, the art of rendering things obscure to those who think they are crystal clear is your first priority. But here, note that the art is not one of practicing, offering inaccessible language or esoteric teachings, but in Socrates' case, in a rather accessible way, the simple yet rare persistence to ask and then linger with a question, such as, what is courage?
And now for our final speaker,
Mr.
Simon Swift.
I'm one of those literature and philosophy people. I'm a literary critic, I'm not a philosopher. So I suppose I'm in that camp of people who've often been accused of obscuring philosophy, introducing metaphor into it, or overvaluing its reliance and its dependence on metaphor. And the borderland between philosophy and poetry is a vexed one, and has been since ancient times, since Socrates. The philosopher I know best is Immanuel Kant, who was absolutely convinced that there should be no problem with the average human intelligence being able to cope with complex philosophical ideas, so long as they're presented in a rigorous and accessible way. And in fact, for Kant, the measure of an idea's validity is its communicability. the fact that you can communicate an idea to others means in some sense that the idea is valid. Obscurity happens in philosophy for Kant in general when people confuse what's going on inside of their heads with what's going on in the world around them. It's a sign of a kind of solipsistic retreat inward that's all the more dangerous because the solipsist doesn't usually or often know that he's retreating inward, that he's being solipsistic. It can be intentional. It can be a kind of impulse of disdain for the public, a kind of aristocratic disdain. Kant often describes it as an attempt to exclude the public from their right, as he saw it, to participate in a culture of reason. Or it can be the result of an overheated imagination, the work of genius and the confusion of intuition for a report on things as they are in the world. So because of this commitment to the communicability of philosophy, Kant necessarily thought that his own dazzlingly complex critical philosophy was accessible to a general public. And he tried to make that philosophy as accessible as possible in all kinds of ways, but for example by depending on metaphor. So he has a famous comparison of the revolution he's trying to bring about in philosophical thinking to the Copernican revolution in astronomy. But there was a problem for him. And the problem was this, that when his first great magnum opus, The Critique of Pure Reason, was published in 1781, no one could understand what he was talking about. And so in a perhaps fairly desperate attempt to make himself understood, he wrote a kind of spark notes version of The Critique of Pure Reason with the amazingly snappy title, Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics That May Be Able to Come Forward as a Science. And when that didn't do the trick, he revised the first work again 6 years later. So a problem with his claim for communicability. And at the same time that Kant was trying to get his ideas across to the reading public, that reading public was increasingly drawn to a different strain in philosophy that Kant calls popular philosophy, which, despite its popularity, its growing popularity, Kant thought was completely incomprehensible, to him at least. It was popular, according to Kant, because it sounded a bit like poetry. It made declarative claims about philosophy's capacity to have an insight or an intuition into questions that we can never really know the answer to from a Kantian point of view. What is the first cause of existence, for example? So you've got this tragic situation, this great philosopher trying to make himself clear, convinced of humanity's interest in and capacity to understand what he's saying, but all the time not being understood. And then this popular lyrical philosophy, heated by the powers of genius, as Kant ironically puts it, gaining a foothold in the public imagination, but doing so by making claims that from a Kantian point of view, or a critical point of view, are strictly incomprehensible and based on a kind of rhapsodic and a poetic style. There's a number of different ways to read this situation, I think. It's tempting to read it as a kind of tragicomic scenario where Kant is kind of overestimating the capacity of any mind, let alone the average public mind, to follow what it is he wants to say. Another way to read it would be, and this is a way in which many literary critics at the moment read Enlightenment prose, such as Kant, as about the problem of Kant's claims for communicability. Claims that can feel weighty, they can feel like a demand for presentable experience. So for Kant, as I've said, there's just no difference between a thought being communicable and it's being a thought. And his whole critical philosophy is based around that assumption. So in some of his late essays, he says things like, if there's a public censor, if the state censors the freedom of philosophers to articulate their thoughts in public, it's no use saying that we can just kind of, we're still free inwardly, we can still, in our conscience, we can, or in our consciousness, we can still have free thoughts. We're not thinking, according to Kant, unless we're able to fully communicate and articulate our thoughts. I think Kant, like all philosophers, is sort of thinking within the confines of his historical moment. He's thinking within a horizon of possibility. And he's aiming towards a particular goal, which for him is this free-thinking public sphere. His is an outward-facing philosophy. At its deepest level, it wants to make itself appear in some way. And one way of reading this is to say that Kant set up a view of the world that guarantees that his thoughts are thinkable and communicable. In other words, the price of clarity is a limiting of the role played by anything that might be obscure or unclear. God, the possibility of insight into the first cause of existence, a thinking of an immortal soul. These things have to be kept out of philosophy. But they can't be kept out of philosophy, and they keep reappearing to him in his thinking. So then thinking clearly becomes about policing a boundary or managing a boundary between what we can know and what we can think about, and providing a set of tools that allow us to orient ourselves in and around these questions that will remain obscure, that necessarily will remain obscure because we don't have the capacity, the faculty to think them. So you're always going to come up against these bigger questions. And I suppose, like the other two speakers, to that extent, I'm suggesting that there's always going to be obscurity in some way in philosophy. Philosophy has to find a way to meet obscurity and to manage its relationship towards it. So, you know, you could argue that Kant, and some literary critics argue that Enlightenment prose, Enlightenment philosophy, has got a kind of naive investment in transparency, in the communicability of inward experience, and that we need to kind of demolish it on that ground. But there's another way of reading him, as I've been trying to suggest, which is about an interest in coping with obscurity and things remaining unclear to the philosophical mind. And in making these kinds of claims, I want to suggest that he leaves a kind of a gap or a space for things to decline appearance, to rest into that in their own obscurity, for obscurity to be left into itself. And just to kind of conclude that thought, so as I said, I'm a literature person. I'm interested in this relationship between poetry and philosophy in particular. And I just wanted to quote very quickly some notes that a German 20th century poet wrote on darkness, on the phenomenon of darkness, which might give us an alternative spin or a poetic spin on this question of communicability. So Paul Celan was working towards a speech that he gave in 1960 called The Meridian. And he's working around a passage that he takes from Pascal, from the Pensée of Pascal, which translated is, do not reproach our obscurity because we make a profession of it. Do not reproach our obscurity because we make a profession of it. And Celan is using this quotation to defend the obscurity of poetry. And this is what he writes in his notes around this quotation from Pascal. We live in an era where one legitimizes oneself lengthily to the outside so as not to have to justify oneself to oneself. In that sense, poetry, in its present mode, preserves for itself the darkness of the illegitimate. It presents itself without references, thus without quotation marks. And then he goes on, leave the poem its darkness. Maybe, and he underlines that word twice, it will give when that excessive brightness, which the exact sciences know today to put before our eyes, will have changed the very ground of the human genotype. Maybe it will, maybe poetry will, on the ground of this ground, provide shade in which man can reflect on his humanity. So poetry and philosophy are both determined by their histories. And maybe the relationship between clarity and obscurity is embedded in that history too, in ways that Celan shows himself to know. Kant's working hard to keep the ontological question, if you like, the question of being, limited, because the focus of his culture is on exposure and communicability and visibility. Now, interestingly, Celan, in these same notes for his speech, associates the novel, the literary form of the novel, with appearing. That's his word for the novel, appearing. So focus on the visible and the manifest. And contrarily, he associates the poem with opacity and resistance to appearing. And of course, Kant is writing at the beginning of the age of the great bourgeois novel, the great literary work of appearance. So, I think, just to conclude very briefly, I think we live in the great age of appearance still. And perhaps one of the reasons why poetry and philosophy have so often joined forces in the post-Kantian world has been to leave a space for what gets left, what gets lost in the excessive brightness of our world, the brightness of the exact sciences, the brightness of the kind of media world that we inhabit. They leave a ground for reflection. I take Celan's claim to be that in a world where everyone claims to be bespeaking themselves fully, and where the effort to uncover what is hidden feels increasingly anachronistic because so little seems to be hidden from us, maybe there is a role again for the encounter that comes with obscurity. Encounter is Celan's word for it. If we live in a world of blinding images that can motivate us to necessary action as much as they stop us in our tracks, perhaps obscurity could offer a space for withdrawn reflection rather than obfuscation.
Thank you. One of the things I was struck by when I was listening to all three talks was the fact that in order to answer the question, and I use the word answer quite loosely here, you all had to reflect upon philosophy's self-understanding. And particularly, I was interested in what you were saying, Simon, about the project of philosophy, and it seemed that philosophy is an impossible project, or at least a very difficult project, in that it seems on the one hand to be aiming at communicability, and on the other hand, it seems to be always managing some kind of obscurity. And those two things seem to be definitely in tension with each other. Does that mean that philosophy is impossible? Does it mean it's always this tension is inescapable?
I mean, the thought that comes to my mind is Beckett, you know, kind of fail better. So the questions have changed, haven't they? I mean, nobody's really, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be a major, like the existence of God, for example, doesn't seem to be the big philosophical question now in the way that it was in the late 18th century, or one of the big philosophical questions. And because of the development of the exact sciences or the hard sciences, you know, we've got different ideas, you know, different approaches to the question of the origin of life. But still, that doesn't mean that, I mean, that doesn't kind of get rid of what we're calling obscurity. It seems as if there is always something that is left unsaid. I don't know. And almost what happens in that shift between then and now is that we increasingly realise that there's a kind of ethical need for that, I suppose, for something, for some sort of reserve to be possible for us, you know, because we live in if for Kant the public world is this kind of wonderful thing where people can come together and freely exchange ideas and develop a culture of reason, for us the public world seems, to my mind anyway, just seems a much darker place where appearance is, as much as it motivates us, you know, I mean, if we didn't see those images of babies being pulled out of the Aegean Sea, you know, we wouldn't perhaps feel the same level of compassion that we do for the people that are trying to make their way into Europe at the moment. But there's also a kind of a blinding quality to that sphere of appearance that is terrifying. That's my sense of it.
To what extent do you, Joseph and Andrew, think that philosophy is this kind of project, this impossible tension between the desire for communicability on one hand, and on the other hand, this kind of drive towards obscurity, or this sense that obscurity is what the way of things, as you said?
No, but I'm not in favour of. I mean, it's very interesting in the Celan, the Meridian speech. I mean, Celan is also very clear to say that what he's doing is not hermeticism. And so I think that, you know, the question tends to bring together hermeticism with being obscure, and no one's arguing for that, I take it. What is being argued, and I think there's a rather nice affinity, is that the nature of things does not give themselves in any direct, immediate way. And therefore the nature of things is that which elicits and demands reflection and demands an understanding that's always mediated. And we've come to see the sort of endearing, you know, naivety in Kant's sense of the open. And indeed it's Arendt who argues, and I think absolutely persuasively, that what we need to do is to rethink, and this is her word now, a concept of dignity after totalitarianism, but that's bound up with the appearance or the capacity to appear in what she calls the space of appearance. And that necessitates us understanding that what it means to be a human, the project of being human, is far more complicated, far more obscure, therefore, and far more worthy of interpretation. We have that on the other hand, and then we have the impulse, which I think comes from, you know, the two great Hegelians. One is Hegel and the other is John Rawls. Rawls is a Hegelian for the precise reason that he understands that if we want justice and fairness, it's not simply my relationship to you or another person, but institutions have to be just and fair. Exactly the same way Hegel argued in the philosophy of right, that an institution must be organized philosophically. If you say that to say that, well, institutions be organized philosophically, someone will say, well, don't be obscure. But actually, the modern university is probably the most unfair, alienating institution in which one could possibly put on courses on justice and fairness. And I think, you know, and while that's amusing on one level, it's also true, and I would emphasize its truth. And so we need to recognize that it's not just the call of the child in the Aegean Sea, important as that absolutely is, but to recognize that the part of the difficulty is to move the domain of the ethical and the political from the notion of a reciprocity between subjects to non-reciprocal relationships, and that is the relationship between institutions and individuals. And in shifting that, we have to rethink dignity as not simply the province of human beings, but the province of those settings in which human beings operate. I mean, Kant, while very important, was, I think, with great respect to Kant, was sort of naive in regards to think that this would come about very happily. We've learnt since totalitarianism that we want. None of this is self-evident. All of this is difficult. All of this is frustrating. And therefore, the embrace of obscurity is not the embrace of hermeticism, but it's an embrace of the fact that the world is not self-evident or at hand. And therefore, it engenders dispute. One last point, and I'll be quiet. There's a wonderfully important moment. There are lots of wonderfully important moments. There's one wonderfully important moment in Aristotle's Politics, in which he's trying to draw a distinction between the political and the household. And the Greek word for house is oikos. It's where we get our word economic from. The notion of governance in the political, the Greek word is plethos, it's where our word plethora comes from. The plethos, as we translated rightly by Hart and Negri, is the multitude. The locus of governance in the political is the multitude. Aristotle then goes on to say, you shift in scale to the oikos, so there probably is only one decision given, there's only two or three members. What we now find is that people will then say, look, if you want to manage the economy, you've got to manage it like the house. And there's only one decision to make about the house, so there's only one decision to make about the economy. This is exactly the situation against which Aristotle warns so presciently 2,000 years ago. Namely, the most political claim imaginable is don't politicize the economic. And yet we think it's so self-evident to say, it's so unobscure, it's so clear that the economy is that about which there can be no contestation. So don't politicize the economic. How dare the democracy sever the link between political decision-making and the economic? Our lives are ruled by banks over which we exercise no democratic control at all. So the current economic system is the abnegation of the democratic. If Rawls were here, he'd be appalled, because now we have institutions of state that are not simply not just and not fair. They are those to which terms, like justice and fairness, are thought to be inappropriate. And yet when you make that point, you're told, oh, you're politicizing the economic, you're making obscure what is so self-evident. None of that's true. There have to be arguments for obscurity, if only because the world demands to be understood as the complex place that it is.
With regard to the question about whether philosophy is an impossible project, I mean, one thing I think everyone here has stressed is that philosophy is partly in the business of fighting against false aspirations to clarity. Either the knowingness of Socrates' culture or self-evident claims about the nature of the relationship between a family's budget and the budget of a nation. But I don't think any of that means that philosophy is an impossible project. Insofar as philosophy is about opening things up, turning things into topics of reflection so that we can try to make some progress on them in our thought, then it's always up against some form of obscurity, mostly because the topics tend to be quite hard to think about. But to that extent, it's not impossible. There is a strain in philosophy, from Hegel's Science of Logic to Tom Nagel's book, The Last Word, that purports to give the final say on whatever topic of philosophy it purports to be talking about. I think there's actually something quite healthy about that strain of philosophy. It's probably never the case that we're going to have the last word on any of these topics: logic, justice, economic justice, the relationship between poetry and philosophy. These topics are so rich, and they invite ongoing reflection that is interminable, but not impossible.
I'd like to come back to this point that you two, Simon and Andrew, raised about the ethical, and you both kind of dropped it in without really unpacking it for us. And I'm really interested in thinking about to what extent the philosophical project is necessarily an ethical project, and what relationship that has to this idea of not making things visible which can't be made visible, which shouldn't be made visible.
In my work, I've become increasingly interested in the relationship between what one may call the fact of existence and the ethical. And as always, I take my lead from this combination, which to me is very important, of Aristotle and Arendt. And I think that when Aristotle, in both the Politics and the Nicomachean Ethics, says that what it means to be a human being, and he uses the word nature, so the very nature of what it means to be a human being is to be a polis dweller, and it's this, the next line is, and it's this that we have in common with others. And so this notion of being in place, a polis dweller, and being in common, being with others, is what defines the being of being human. And it seems to me that therefore one can argue, and it becomes a sort of virtue ethics type of argument, that there is the ethical is there in virtue of being human. So there's, in my work I use the expression virtue in being. There is virtue in being. So the ethical is not a contingent predicate of the being of being human. And that's why I think Arendt is so important. When she says that he says, by more or less quoting, it's something like, for the Romans, the most political of people to be and to be amongst men, inter hominis esse, being amongst men, are the same thing. And what becomes so important in Arendt is the inter, the I-N, little Latin word, I-N-T-E-R, this, that you announce that the original condition is the condition of relationality. So what we negotiate as subjects is our always already being in relation to other subjects. And I think that then becomes an ontological claim. Like, what it's, just to use the language, what it means to be a human being is to be with others. We always think that we precede relationality. We don't. Andrew Benjamin is nothing other than the after effect of the network of relations that constitutes his life. Bless you. I will meet new people in time to come. The relations that constitute me will change. I'll become estranged from people I used to know. The relations that constitute me change. But individuals are constituted by relationality. Relationality is the interarticulation for me of placidness and commonality. And it seems to me that therefore it's so important not to see the ethical as some contingent possibility, though it's defined by freedom, so everyone has the right, as it were, not to act ethically. But nonetheless, the ethical is not like putting on a red shirt as opposed to a blue shirt. The ethical is intrinsic to the being of being human. I think that's what Aristotle and Epicurus and the great virtue ethic tradition realized, but it was thinkers like Arendt and others who gave it this much stronger ontological force. So the ethical to me is sort of not something that you do ontology and then you do ethics. Like, to be is to be in relation. Levinas is the other great thinker of precisely this predicament.
Again, I feel like I have to keep making the apology that I'm not a philosopher, so I feel like I'm kind of an amateur in some ways thinking about these questions. But it seems to me that ethics is a part of philosophy, isn't it? Along with physics and logic and all the other parts. But then we also tend to think of the philosophical project in some way as ethical. And I suppose it's, you know, so those are two different things, just to kind of notice that, I suppose, that there's a formal domain of philosophy, which is ethics. And then the question or the reflection on the ethical nature of the philosophical project. But then all intellectual disciplines have an ethics, don't they? I mean, they all exist to improve the world in some way. So, you know, there's a question there, isn't there, about whether philosophy is more ethical than history or literary criticism or physics. So that would be one thought. And then the other thought would just be about, because you're right, I mean, we both kind of turned to ethics, and it does seem to be linked in some way to obscurity, and that's something I've always resisted. I suppose that's why I got interested in Kant in the first place, because I just had this very naive kind of utopian PhD student view that we could kind of have some sort of transparent understanding or moment of recognition, and I couldn't stand all that kind of theologically infused ethical thought about obscurity. But as I get older, I find myself more and more convinced that ethics is about obscurity. So, because I suppose things seem less clear. So that's a very anecdotal, biographical, inconclusive response to your question.
I mean, there are two reactions. I mean, one is, I think that philosophy, at least as it's de facto practiced, is not, for the most part, an ethical endeavor. That is to say, there's plenty of philosophers working on problems that have nothing to do with ethics, and to take the ethics as a component of philosophy. But it's also the case that they don't think of themselves as, in any sense, improving the world. They just have a speculative interest in this problem. I mean, that's perfectly... that sense of philosophy has a long history, and I think it's perfectly... perfectly adequate and okay, just like the physicist wants to figure out the physical world. But what I found very interesting about Danielle's question, which links up with Simon's remarks, is this idea that of some kind of ethical obligation in philosophy to leave some things unsaid. And this is something it sounds like you've become more attracted to as you've matured. And I suppose I'm still in the naive phase of enlightenment communicability as the ideal of philosophical practice. I mean, a distinction is worth drawing between the Ceylon Meridian kind of case, where the references and the languages in the poem, it takes so much work to figure out what's going on. It's not immediately apparent. It's obscure in the sense that one has to be erudite, one has to know lots of different languages, just like he did. But one, you know, you can imagine, like you do, and I haven't, having the text before you and figuring it all out. This refers to that, and learning about his life and where he's lived and why he said that then and so forth. And then you can imagine yourself thinking, I figured it out. There, you know, I've got, I can explain this. I can teach this. But the idea, that's different, isn't it, than that sense of obscurity, than leaving something unsaid. And it's a very interesting ethical obligation that's being put forward. And I just wonder if we can come up with examples of such a thing. Philosophy, on my naive view, is in the business of hunting for intelligibility. And that means articulating that intelligibility. What would it mean to be ethically obligated as a philosopher to leave things unsaid? One can imagine that as a teacher, of course, in a classroom or in a tutorial, when you're inducting someone into the practice of philosophy. But as a writer, leaving things unsaid, I just re-raise it actually as a question.
It's often something that philosophers are attacked for, isn't it? Anyone thinks of Heidegger and his silence, just as an example, you know, that there's a difference between knowing something and not saying it, and not asking the question, I suppose, or leaving the question open. So there are different modes of silence or reserve, I guess. I'd challenge a little bit your distinction between the kind of hermeneutic work one might do with Celan and, I don't know, I'm guessing the kind of work that you do. I mean, it is absolutely the case, isn't it, that one of the things that's really attractive about philosophy is the simplicity of the questions it asks at the outset. It asks very simple questions, usually, and then shows how complicated or obscure those questions are, but they appear simple. And so maybe with the literary text, if you like, one begins with an obscurity. I mean, your narrative suggests that we begin with some kind of obscurity and move towards clarity. But still, I wonder whether it's quite as clear-cut as that. I mean, I don't feel as if I'm doing a substantially different work when I'm interrogating a literary text from when I'm interrogating a philosophical text, and that's not because I'm constantly trying to find the blind spots in the philosophy. Do you know what I mean? It's we're still reading, in some sense. I mean, I wonder to what extent you see your work as primarily a work of reading.
Yeah, a lot of it's that. A lot of the texts I work on require that. But the question, I guess the question of truth, the question of plausibility, the question of believability with respect to some philosophical topic is always on the table when one is doing the reading. So to that extent, there might be a distinction between a literary form of reading and a philosophical form of reading.
But just to go back to your interest in Socrates, I mean, you know, what's so intriguing about, you know, like the Socrates of the Euthyphro, for example? You know, here comes this guy who says, I know what piety is. I'm going to take my father to court because his actions led to the death of a slave. I know what a pious person does. It's very simple, as you're saying. And what happens is a beautiful moment in which Socrates undoes the arrogance and certainty of the young Euthyphro. And at the end, what's amazing is the dialogue just ends. All we know is that we don't know what piety is, and we're left with a problem. So I think one of the interesting things about the Socratic method is not whether it's ironic or anything, that's not interesting. What is interesting is that it undermines, it has a sceptical position, but it's that very scepticism that becomes the precondition for some sort of argumentation. And the response to Socrates is therefore doubled, isn't it? Because on the one hand, he's undermining a certainty. But what he's also doing is, and this is the point I was trying to make, and I mean it's implicit in what you're saying as well, is that what the Socratic method demands is that we are free to debate. And so there's an implicit recognition that philosophy is democratic, precisely because it needs that moment in which Euthyphro can advance his position and Socrates can advance his position without that position being threatened, which makes the apology the most interesting, you know, dialogue of the lot, or one of the most interesting, precisely because at that particular moment it's the clash between the demands of the state and the demands of philosophy. And you can see that whether philosophy speaks about the ethical or the political as its subject matter, the very practice itself, the being philosophical, and the necessity to disagree and agree, brings with it a democratizing tendency. So I think you're right to say, absolutely, that there are lots of philosophers who don't see that the subject matter of what they deal with is the ethical. And I think that's completely right, a lot don't. But it's the very freedom to be philosophical, to dispute, as Kant so wonderfully talks about the distinction in conflict and dispute throughout his writings. It's the possibility of genuine conflict, which we have by nature, which is defines the philosophical on one level. And that, I think, it means that's why things are left in the dark. It's because it's not because we're mystics, God forbid. It's precisely because there is a level of hubris. Sorry, a level of an anti-hubris, rather. There's a level of sort of humility in relation to the difficulty of the subject matter, and to know that any decision one makes is contestable. You still hold it with passion, but nonetheless the inelimitable contestability of a decision is in some sense what threatens philosophy, but it's equally philosophy's strength. And so I think that one must recognise that the subject matter differs slightly from, as it were, the context of the philosophical as a intellectual or as a cultural activity. And that's why when you close down civil society, take the history of Iran, one of the first things you do is close down philosophy departments. Not because philosophers are a threat, but because philosophy implicitly brings with it the necessity to hold the realm of dispute open.
Then I wonder if that's distinctive. I agree with you that that's true of philosophy, and in that sense it's an ethical practice. Yeah. But it doesn't seem distinctive of philosophy then. Watch collective deliberation in a scientific lab, where respect for everyone's voice, when it goes well, is crucial for the enterprise.
Now might be a good time to take some questions from the audience. If you could keep your questions quite short, that would be much appreciated. Gentleman at the back.
What I was wondering is that back to the point you mentioned, the last one, Andrew, regarding the practice. Don't you think that before answering the question of does philosophy have to be obscure, we have to make a distinction between philosophy as a question, set of questions, or act of philosophizing? There's a big difference between them. As a question, I don't think that's obscure because it is very basic. What is good, what is bad? But in order to answer the questions, to address the question, then that's when obscurity comes up. Don't you think, what I'm trying to say, do you think there's a distinction between philosophizing as an act and philosophical questions?
Well, I agree to a certain extent that you could make the philosophical question straightforward, but your own examples of what is good is hardly a straightforward question. I mean, if we knew the answer, it would be very simple. I sort of feel that I would want to deflect all of this and say that really that what philosophy is concerned about is the constant examination and re-examination of criteria of judgment. And it seems to me that the danger is to privilege finality, and hence that's why I'm always very interested in this idea that there's an openness. And it seems to me that the judgment then becomes such an important term. So in the teaching of philosophy, my view is that what one is doing is teaching criteria of judgment and evaluating judgment. So therefore, if we go back to your question, the question of the good, of course, is a difficult question, but we have to begin to work out how to pose it. The obscurity emerges if one flees from the question. So I think someone said before that the obscure person is the one who, I think you used this wonderful word, who obfuscates in front of the question, who puts off confronting either the difficulty or the simplicity of the question. So obfuscation, if you like, is the real obscurantist project.
Anyone else want to respond to that?
Hello, my name is Vereniki. I have a question with regards to what is philosophy, because I understand your point of view that it's about teaching the judgment, but maybe we should have a distinction between the academic philosophy and philosophy with the purpose of learning people to have a better life, really to increase the quality of our life. So maybe there should be a distinction in 2015 about this? What do you think? Because if it's not the purpose of philosophy to increase the quality of our life, then what is the purpose of philosophy?
Please. You're the guy.
I'm glad you asked. There is a place in London called the Philosophy of Life. It's an institution, and I think it's devoted to making its students' lives better. And the ancient the philosophical context obviously had that resonance. Pierre Hadot, a well-known French scholar of antiquity, is good on how showing us how philosophy was essentially a kind of way of life. Ancient skepticism, for example, in contrast to the way modern skepticism is depicted, was more explicitly something that was lived rather than just speculated about in one study. In 2015, I suppose you want to say, now that we're no longer in togas and so forth, we should... You're Greek, okay. We should,
still toga-free.
We should respect the difference between academic philosophy and philosophy of life, if you will. The nightmare of all graduate students or junior professors of philosophy is, or indeed anyone who works in a serious way about philosophy, is to be in the airport and to be asked what one does, and then you say, and then the response is, well, let me tell you about my philosophy. That's the philosophy of life bit, right? I would resist the strict distinction between academic philosophy and philosophy that's in the business of, in some sense, guiding human beings. There are a lot of forms of philosophy, such as my colleagues who do philosophy of physics and other more speculative forms of philosophy, that make very little contact with the human at all, much less guide their lives. But at least with respect to the philosophies out there, the topics, the questions, the writers who are interested in the human affairs, one could make the minimal point that Andrew has, I think, been stressing, that to the extent that you read this kind of philosophy and think about it and talk about it, then you're already entered into a kind of deliberation that's going to make you a better person in the sense of a better participant in a collective practice of autonomous decision making. So in that minimal sense, if you're looking for a guidebook, a menu about, whether you should go out with her or whether you should become a vegetarian, there are some, I suppose, philosophical tracks that could be helpful. But that kind of direct relationship to guiding people's lives and their decisions, I would resist. But in a more kind of formal sense of philosophy playing a role in becoming something as a person, yeah, I don't think we should give that up and just call philosophy a kind of specialized science, just like the rest of the specialized sciences. It's important that there's a kind of naivete to philosophy, and that shouldn't be left behind, in my view.
No, Robin, I agree. I think that there's a trap between a false distinction between academic and non-academic philosophy, and I think that it's too easy to hive off the academic so that it then becomes irrelevant. But given that you're Greek, that the zoon politikon is a thinking of life, the Greek notion of the eudaimon, and what it means to be a eudaimon these days, we have this banal, stupid English word, happy. You know, like, what a dumb word. I mean, it's much better in this sense to be German and talk about Glück or Glückseligkeit, which you can be a miserable bugger and still have Glück. In other words, that happiness and having fortune, which is what the Greeks meant by eudaimon and eudaimonia. And so we'd have to say, all right, what does it mean to be fortunate, to have fortuna today? And that would then cause us to recognize that it's possible to think, and I think this to my mind is a very dangerous but important point. I mean, both Heidegger and Plato taught us that we philosophers should not be politicians. When we do it, it's not done well. So therefore, it's probably best to think that the job of philosophy is to think philosophically about the political. We know that things like racism, sexism, poverty are not good. We know this. But how do we know it philosophically? We know it philosophically because, to use the Arendt expression I've used before, someone who is forced into poverty, someone because of the colour of their skin who's not allowed to participate in the space of appearance, someone because of their gender is restricted in a role in the space of appearance, these are ontological problems. They may be bad, but that's irrelevant. What's relevant is that they strike the very thing of what it means to be a human being. Now, it's very clear that the tax credits that are being argued about at the moment are going to enforce poverty. Now, not being a politician, I'm not interested in the political backwards and forwards. What I am saying, if one wanted to understand tax credits and the arguments put forward by Cameron et al., where it's justified economically, their philosophical, their argument is that you can justify the creation of poverty on the basis that the economy is that over which we cannot debate. All right? That's a philosophical claim. I'm not saying that Corbyn or the others have got it right in response. They're not interested. But what I am interested in is what professional or non-professional philosophers can do is take a topic like poverty or racism or sexism, whatever you wish, and think about it philosophically. So our job is not to become politicians. That's not our job. Our job is to think. And the thinking is precisely that moment in which we take a stand, philosophical stand, within culture. And I believe it's very important, personally I believe, it's very important that the philosopher is not the politician, but we maintain a space of thinking. And something as straightforward and as banal on one level as tax credits, because they're inextricably bound up with the creation and the maintenance of poverty, are philosophically important. So that elides, to my mind, the difference between academic and non-academic philosophy. But what it does do is that it shows that there's no topic, as it were, that falls outside the province of the philosophical. And that, to my mind, is what philosophy has to recognise.
Let's take another question.
Philosophy is outside of my discipline, so if I make a fool of myself, it's okay too with me. There is a very excited, very busy student asked his rabbi, he said to him, "Rabbi, shall I study philosophy?" And the rabbi said, "If you have time between sunrise and sunset, study philosophy." And then he said to him, "But remember that the world is suspended on nothingness. You are thrown into the world, and each one of us attempt to make a meaning of it." But I don't know much about philosophy, but people try to go to mythology, maths, opinion, self-understanding, the Delphi, and all that stuff. How come the philosophers themselves couldn't have a life that lived more or less adequately? And I'm surprised that you are mentioning the word obscure. Leibniz, in a way, 200 years before Freud, thought of the unconscious, that dark continent. So if we is it a way that we can make that unconscious conscious in order to...
Okay, so it's two sort of different questions then. One about philosophers' lives and one about the unconscious and the relationship between the unconscious and the obscure. Two questions, three blank faces.
My rabbi said to go work for your father, and he wasn't a philosopher.
We can take another question, shall we? Yeah.
Hi, I'll try to keep this brief. I couldn't help thinking of Bourdieu's postscript to distinction while you were having your discussion, and there we have a sociologist's account of why philosophy is and indeed must be obscure, and the basis of it is something like that rare competences produce and sustain social distinction. The issue then wouldn't be whether we could try and make philosophy more obscure or less obscure. Philosophers would be producing distinction in taking either side of the debate. So you would be an example of the production of distinction here. And the point of taking a sociological point of view is that the philosopher is the last person that should be asked this question, because if we're looking at the practice of philosophy, we've got to take a position outside of it. I don't know whether I think that's true myself. As a teacher of philosophy, I think there's something to it. But I'm just wondering whether you think you guys, even you at the end, not being a philosopher, as you've kept saying, interestingly, whether you think you're the people to ask.
I'm not sure I fully understood the question. To ask about distinction, to ask about Bourdieu's idea of distinction. I don't think I fully understood the question.
We can just keep going until you find a question you like.
I use the term loosely. Bourdieu was the thinker fueled by ressentiment, all right? And, you know... so is the notion of distinction brought up in a serious academic context. If the argument for distinction is to make philosophers unable to take responsibility or to talk about themselves, then, you know, this is simply not true, because philosophy is absolutely intrinsically involved in its own activity. And the other thing that fuels the question is a failure to understand the complexity around the word obscurity. And the whole point of our arguments has nothing to do with obscurity in that cheap sense. It has to do with obscurity as the problem of avoiding the reduction of the world to the self-evident, i.e. the problem of avoiding the banality of sociology.
Yeah, I'm a bit worried by Andrew Benjamin's emphasis on obscurity, like the questioner before last and to some extent the previous questioner. I mean, it does seem to me that, you know, if one is a Heideggerian, one takes a passive view towards epistemology, because Heidegger thought that the world was gradually unconcealing itself to us, and that therefore it doesn't really matter how we try to understand the world and what priorities we make. Whereas Hegel, who of course...
Frame this as a question.
Whereas Hegel thinks that we should adopt an active epistemological approach to the world and try to make priorities in terms of the questions we ask. Now, it does seem to me that that is the right way to go, and that Heidegger is actually... elevated obscurity way above its proper status. Would you agree with that?
Me? I'm not going to make a defence of one way or the other of Heidegger's writing style. It's a separate question. I would, however, defer here to say that this idea of the difficulty of recovering the project from what there is intrinsic to a certain way of thinking. I also would resist, with the greatest respect, the formulation of Heidegger. I don't think Heidegger at all is making that argument. I think that there is a great deal of currency in German thought about in the 20s, in which you can link Walter Benjamin, Heidegger, a great many thinkers, all for whom what was the problem was the fact that what was at hand at the moment, the way the present understood itself, obscured, as it were, the reality of things. And what was essential was an interruption of the present, an argument for its discontinuous with itself in order that something else emerge. I mean, the classic formulation of this is Marx's last thesis on the philosophy of Feuerbach. When Marx says philosophers have interpreted the world, what he means by that is that philosophers interpret the world, philosophy stays the same, the world stays the same, pointless activity. Then he says the point is to change it, but that's a very bad translation. The German is verändern, which allows the much groovier translation of to other the world. So what the project Marx is giving rise to, arguing for, is the othering of the world, which presupposes that the world is otherable. But both Benjamin and Heidegger, I think, are deeply implicated not in a Marxist project, but in the project that says that the world as that which is at hand is, for a whole series of reasons, not to be continued with. The implicit proposition or supposition is that the world can be othered. And the thinkers against this, and this is a perfect place in which to say this, the profound philosophical positions against this are Burke, Popper, and Brandom. This is philosophical conservatism at its richest, namely that you cannot other the world, all you have is amelioration. And when Popper and when Burke is horrified by the French Revolution, when Popper argues rightly for a conjecture refutation model, this is philosophical conservatism, which is not a bad thing. It's another way of thinking philosophically, in which the world is as it is and amelioration is our way through it. The Marxist tradition, which will hold, bizarrely, Heidegger and Benjamin, allows for the othering of the world. So I would, with the greatest respect, not want to pursue your description of Heidegger, and I would allow Heidegger, for all his faults, a far more radical project than the one you're allowing.
Okay, we are running out of time, so let's take two questions together and finish on those. So, gentlemen here.
Yeah. The phenomenon of obscurity in philosophy seems to be linked to philosophical language, and especially Anglo-Saxon philosophers have put forward many requirements for philosophical language during the last century. In your own work, which of these requirements do you accept, and which do you refuse to accept categorically, and why?
And
yeah, this is the issue of sort of unintended obscurity. William James had the famous quip that philosophy is the dogged struggle to achieve clarity. Yes, philosophy, dogged struggle to achieve clarity. Now, if we go to economics, we get W.F. Jevons saying that for economics to be a science, it must be mathematical. And J.K. Galbraith quips back, well, the mathematical is then going to jettison the moral. So my sort of question is what... would you go along with Bertrand Russell, the sort of idea that the greatest challenge for any thinker is stating the problem in a way that will allow a solution? Now, the mathematics, of course, we get mathematics.
Thanks. Okay.
Economics and...
Responses to one or both of those questions.
I would agree with Bertrand Russell.
The idea that if you can't say it clearly, you don't understand it yourself, which a well-known analytic philosopher once said in Berkeley, is a requirement or a dictum that I endorse. One that I reject is the idea that when one tries to say things clearly, one is never allowed to come up with modifications of English language words, in our case, jargon, in other words, in order to try to capture phenomena that the present resources of English as a natural language are not somehow offering us. So the idea of introducing technical terminology, if you will, into philosophy Sometimes that's been a requirement that to not do that has sometimes been depicted as a requirement. Ordinary language philosophers, for example, sometimes forbade that practice, and I would reject that. So you might want to use the word nothing sometimes as a noun, as in the nothing. There might be something that you're trying to say.
I would very much endorse this. And one of the great problems that's happened with the way in which English language philosophy has responded to philosophy in German and French is that we're allowed to write books about Deleuze and Derrida, but we're not really allowed to think in English. And the analytic philosophers are happy to think in English. They're happy to invent words quite happily. And I think that we should mine the resources of English as something that is a proper object within which one can think. So I completely endorse this idea that we should push at the resources of English as that which occasions thought, and we should do more than merely comment. As opposed, in regard to the question before about the Jevons point, I mean, I actually, in some sense, completely agree with this. My attraction to Kant and to Derrida is over this precise point, is that, and it's a wonderful point that Levinas makes as well. If you were as ghastly a person as a utilitarian, you could sleep happily at night because you've got limited resources, limited time. I'm busy, and I can just do only a certain number of things. I sleep well. Levinas quite rightly comes back and says, the only ethical category is insomnia. Why? Because the call on us of unconditionality, of unconditional justice, unconditional hospitality, that call is ineliminable. That call is that with which we negotiate endlessly. It is, and this is where Derrida uses a word of Kant's, it is incalculable. And when Kant talks about in throughout his writings of the notion of the unbedingt, the unconditioned, what he means is has been taken over by Derrida without argument as such. And the unconditioned is there, and every condition has an unconditioned for it. So every hospitable act, every act of justice, never exhausts the hold of the unconditioned. There is no calculation. Mathematics will only betray in the sense of deny, but betray in the sense of show the hold of the inelimitability of the unconditioned. And so it therefore matters terribly that calculus, you know, that cheap tool of the utilitarian, can achieve nothing when it comes to acting ethically. Then there has to be humility linked to the ethical, and I think that's what Levinas and Derrida and Kant, ironically, to put them all together, are all about. So I think you're absolutely right to say that when you have calculability, the ethical is abandoned.
It sounds a lot like you're wishing insomnia on all of us.
Yes, quite. Well, I am actually, for what it's worth.
We have run out of time, so we'll have to finish there. I'd like to thank you all for coming and ask you to join me in thanking our speakers.